Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. We're also on the internet at www.cjsf.ca. We stream all our shows. You can also listen to our podcasts at soundcloud.com/CJSF. We have such a fantastic show for you today. A little later on in the show, you'll be hearing from the indomitable Richard Dawkins. He's out with his second volume of his memoir, A Brief Candle in the Dark. And coming up shortly, you'll be hearing from David Christopher, PhD candidate and professor at the University of Victoria, who is attempting to start a class on Star Wars. And with the new movie coming out next week, we thought it was apt to talk to someone from the fandom world of Star Wars. And we'll also be having music from the Kyla Koopman Band. But first, we have just a couple of announcements for you. This is the Kyla Koopman Band with their new single, Habits. That was the Kyla Koopman Band with their song Habits. Stay tuned for their EP coming out early next year. Well, December 18th, 2015 is a day that many, many people have been waiting for a very, very, very long time. Of course, it is the release of Star Wars The Force Awakens, the seventh movie in the saga and the first since 2005's Revenge of the Sith. There are so many theories. There are so much to dissect, and I have one man on the phone with me who can help us. He is Professor David Christopher at the University of Victoria, and he is an avid Star Wars fan and is in hope trying to get a class on Star Wars on the curriculum. David, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. How are you? And I have to start by correcting you. I am not a professor. I'm actually a PhD candidate in cinema.
Oh, okay. My apologies. So, PhD candidate in cinema and quite an avid Star Wars fan, I take it.
Absolutely.
Like so many of us. When did you first? I mean, obviously, you probably saw the first film, A New Hope. But when did it first become apparent to you that Star Wars was a really good film, and what did you like about it?
Well, you know, the uninteresting answer to that question is in 1977. It became apparent to me when I was 7 years old. Of course, it's become apparent to me again and again in different contexts as my cinematic taste matured or became more intellectually informed. But, you know, the fun answer is when I was 7 years old in 77, I was in the back of my best friend's parents' wood-paneled station wagon at an Ottawa drive-in, expecting not much on the screen, and this movie came on, and of course it changed my life at that moment. It's a funny sort of backstory. My father, about a month earlier, had suggested he was going to a movie with my uncle, and so as an impetuous seven-year-old, I said, can I come? And then he told me the name of the film was something called Star Wars, and I thought to myself, oh my, one of those World War One documentary type films that Dad likes, and I was immediately uninvested, only to be shocked a month later at what that movie actually was.
when it first came out, everyone said that it changed cinema, or at least that particular genre of cinema. Would you agree with that? How do you think it changed how we view movies?
I would agree with that. You know, sometimes that's been perhaps overemphasized, but you know, it can be defended. First of all, you know, the type of science fiction that we were getting in wide distribution at that time, especially out of Hollywood, had come to have a reputation of being B films. You know, animation was typically large costumes or stop motion. And not to take away from the genius of some of the stop motion animators, but it certainly was empty of some of the realism that we have come to expect in cinema today, especially, you know, following the computer generation. And I think in terms of computer generated graphics, although they were not doing that at that time, the inception of Industrial Light and Magic and some of the innovative ways they were making the space scenes with the green screens, and even just the costuming, I think it really did sort of begin a new era. Following Star Wars, virtually every science fiction blockbuster that you might name just off the top of your head, of course, employed Industrial Light and Magic. So it became the Hollywood standard. And that's only an industrial level. You know, the second part of your question, it changed how we talk about movies. Star Wars was... you know, it was a brilliant piece of melodrama. It conceived a new mythology for its fan base. It was a brilliant piece of science fiction. Ideologically, it was, I think, highly conservative, but really representative of a change in cinema. It, along with Jaws in the same year, sort of changed blockbusters towards visual spectacle, superseding narrative spectacle, as opposed to the other way around, which I think it had been for a long, long time in many of the Hollywood cycles.
You mentioned it was a brilliant piece of melodrama. At least the first three were. I still think Return of the Jedi is one of the best films I've ever seen. But then the turn of the new century came around, and we got three new Star Wars movies, which weren't as well received, I would say, as the original trilogy.
I think that's an understatement. I think you're being politically gentle.
I mean, I do think that Revenge of the Sith was easily the best out of that trilogy. But what do you make of what George Lucas was trying to do with the prequel trilogy, and where do you think he went wrong?
Well, you know, I hesitate to sort of speculate on what Lucas was trying to do. The easy answer to that is, of course, make money, which is almost always the priority with any sort of Hollywood corporation. But I don't know what he was trying to do. Maybe revisit childhood glory as middle age began to take its toll over at the Skywalker Ranch there. But I can certainly answer where he went wrong, I think, in terms of how he alienated a fan base. And first of all, it wasn't all awful. You know, my kids, who were new to Star Wars at the time, they love it, you know, because they didn't have anything invested in sort of an identity construction from the 70s and early 80s that might have been compromised by anything that Lucas did. But, you know, I think that these films were evidence of a young guy who had developed a reputation for being a genius filmmaker, which I think may have been a little bit too much credit for Lucas. I think that he was brilliant at certain things, but I also think he got really lucky with the original Star Wars trilogy, hitting a lot of the right marks at the right time. And then the prequel trilogy, to me, it's really strong evidence of a creative filmmaker having exhausted his creativity after 25 years of corporate leadership. I mean, that's an otherwise pretty strong editorial on the effects of capitalism, but I really think that is what happened. And I think that he was, again, trying to sort of dip into the glory of his youthful filmmaking by creating this backstory that had been, you know, touched on in the original trilogy, but I don't think he created one the way that it was imagined in many people's minds. Of course, we all imagine certain things like the Clone Wars, just briefly mentioned, dismissively mentioned in the first movie, and I don't think that the way he imagined it was the way that his fan base imagined it. And then, of course, you can point to the really obvious stuff. Jar Jar Binks was, you know, an irritating character that I think was supposed to be sort of in the spirit of C-3PO, you know, sort of a foppish type of character, comic relief type character, but George Lucas really tipped his hand with some ideological racism in terms of that character, and that in conjunction with the fact that the character was just irritating on the screen, I think was a real negative. But I think the biggest thing, I have to be frank, it was the introduction of midichlorians. So if you're a Star Wars fan, you'll know that this was sort of the blood type that is exclusive to those who are force sensitive. You know, and in the first trilogy, the Force was a mystic thing. It was an almost religious thing, even for viewers. It was mystical. On the Millennium Falcon, Han Solo says, "I don't believe in," you know, Luke Skywalker says, "You don't believe in the Force, do you?" And Han Solo responds with, "Oh, hokey religions, etc." This is the language of belief. This is the language of mysticism in which anyone can participate. You know, if you believe strong enough, you'll have the Force. And all of us from that generation then spent decades trying to levitate our television remote controls, just believing maybe the Force is real. And then this sort of shortcut to explain why Anakin Skywalker was so powerful with the Force, this blood-type shortcut called midichlorians, completely evacuated the mysticism, the religion of it. It became eugenic. You know, you were either born with this type of blood or you weren't, and it could be measured with a simple blood test from a cut on your arm, and it sort of erased a whole generation of mythical investment. And I really think that narrative shortcut emptied a lot of the value for the original fan base.
You brought up Jar Jar Binks, and I quickly want to touch on that because he's probably the most maligned character in the franchise. And you mentioned C-3PO, and I recently read an interesting theory that I think stemmed from Reddit that said Jar Jar was actually created to be kind of a Sith version of Yoda, and that Well, first, in Attack of the Clones, Lucas makes him a subtle villain when he stands in for Amidala and is the one that casts the deciding vote to give Palpatine supreme powers. And that also Count Dooku was created to fill the holes left by Jar Jar in the plot holes when they decided that they weren't going to include Jar Jar as much in episode 2 and 3 because he was so hated, and that the battle between Dooku and Yoda was originally supposed to be between Yoda and Jar Jar. I wanted to get your thoughts on whether you think that's actually a legitimate theory.
I've been interrogated on this a couple of times since it came up, and at the risk of alienating all of those invested in it, I've expressed before, no, this is not a legitimate theory, and for a number of reasons, not the least of which is, you know, step away from any investment you have in fan fiction and the expanded universe, and you can sum it up by saying, come on, clearly this was a foppish, intellectually short-changed character. It would be a pretty big narrative stretch to make that type of a connection. I mean, the simplest character evaluation would demonstrate that if he was any kind of a Sith, he's like a white villain. He's like, as opposed to a black melodramatic villain in terms of those character types, you know, he's a comic villain. He would be an unthreatening villain. And the idea that he had some sort of external agenda that was hidden from the narrative. I mean, you could write that story, but I can't buy it. I don't buy into that. I think that that is an attempt to recuperate the hatred of poor Jar Jar Binks a little bit by, you know, painting some evil over what might have been his backstory. But even the Clone Wars certainly don't lend itself to any of that. So, you know, if I read a story that was really, really compelling, that created a backstory, that all of his foolishness and his comic relief was just a cover, okay, sure, but I would have to give that author more genius credit than Lucas himself for convincing me on that count.
You mentioned before that, and this has been brought up before, that there are sort of shreds of racism in the way Jar Jar was characterized, because he was a little bit perhaps Rastafarian. And then I read something recently that fans on Twitter primarily wanted to boycott the new Star Wars film because they had a black man and a woman in the lead. What do you make of this odd discourse that we're having, you know? Yes, we should have more diversity in films, and yet when it comes up, people are like, "Oh, I don't want to see it now because we're oppressing white people or whatever." What do you make of that?
Well, you know, the Jar Jar Binks character, I think that those are separate discourses. I think conflating them is a little bit of a disservice. I mean, both of them deal obviously with race relations, but I think they're really opposite sides of the coin. Jar Jar Binks, you know, Rastafarian is only one of the stereotypes that he represented. Certainly his use of pigged in English, his gait, you can see a lot of these conventions out of, all through the 19th and 20th century, we see a lot of these types of racial stereotypes that are, you know, really summed up in Jar Jar Binks. This might as well have been a minstrel show, right down to the vest and other stereotypes that I'd rather not articulate, but I think everyone is familiar with them. You know, Mad TV made light of this with an entry where they introduced Aunt Jar Jar Mima as a satire on just how obviously racially offensive this is. And then the other side of the coin, where you have a discourse emerging now about the perils of white privilege, which is not a discourse that I think is a legitimate discourse, to be quite honest. If you have a racial opinion to the point that a black hero in a Star Wars movie is offensive to you, I'm sorry that you would be hard-pressed to present any sort of argument that I think could be convincing. You know, historically we have a lot of different types of role stratification, role segregation. We've had a whole history of Caucasian actors playing every type of race. You know, I heard an argument recently by Ridley Scott about his version of the Ten Commandments, and he demonstrated sort of some of the racism that is inherent to a wide swath of the audience population. He was criticized for this, for casting white actors as both Moses and the Pharaoh's son. I can't remember the character's name in his version of the Ten Commandments. And his response was practical, but I think indicative of a deep racist malaise, where he said, you know, if you spend this kind of money on a movie, you can't cast somebody whose first name is Muhammad if you have any hope of making your money back. Now, I'm not saying I agree with his opinion, but it's an astute financial observation on what the demographics of the audiences are looking for. You know, I think that investing in the race of a hero is unfortunate. I don't think we shouldn't talk about it. Obviously, it's an issue. But, you know, Jar Jar Binks was an offensive racial character, I think. I think he represented a lot of archaic stereotypes, and Lucas tipped his hand a little bit on that one. And I think Finn looks awesome. I got to be honest. I think he looks like a great character.
I would also argue that throughout the series, there has actually been a fantastic representation of diversity. Not through, you know, you've got Finn, you had Jango Fett, who was a Maori actor, but also just all of the different species, the different races that are represented throughout the trilogy. What do you think George Lucas has done to show diversity on screen?
Well, I'll be honest, Dan, I think I'm a little more cynical than you are. I think that typically we evaluate science fiction and fantasy film as this sort of championing of diversity, because it's demonstrating all of these aliens. But I think that, you know, an examination... So, yes, George Lucas put a huge diversity of aliens on the screen, but again, I think we have to look at the narrative stratification. First of all, all of the characters were, you know, white, semi-bourgeois representations. Look at the most diverse alien base in the first movie was basically in the ghetto. It was in a bar where everyone was drunk and violence was acceptable in what Obi-Wan Kenobi refers to as a hive of scum and villainy. And, you know, other aliens are never in particularly valorized types of roles. You know, maybe in the new trilogy you get to see the Jedi Council, which is obviously has a diversity of aliens, and maybe Yoda, you know. But no, I can't say that the ideological underpinnings of some of these alien representations are particularly progressive. It's great that he participated with science fiction in bringing these characters to the screen, but, you know, instead of a wholesale valorization of just bringing diversity to the screen, I think we need to really examine how that diversity is being represented and interrogate whether it's as progressive as it might seem on the surface.
All right, so let's get to The Force Awakens. It opens next week. And I know for me personally, and I think I've talked to a lot of people about this as well, they seem more excited for The Force Awakens than they were for, let's say, The Phantom Menace.
Really?
Well, I think it's I think it's a retroactive excitement, and what I mean by that is, because the prequel trilogies weren't nearly as good as they were hyped out to be, and because of who the director of The Force Awakens is, J.J. Abrams, there is a greater hype that it's going to be a better movie. So I think the excitement is greater on that front, I would say.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think that there's somewhat of a disavowal, a retroactive disavowal going on when the fans say, you know, I'm more excited for this new trilogy than I was for the prequel trilogy, because in hindsight, everyone kind of doesn't think much of the prequel trilogy, but I think the excitement is palpable, most certainly. I haven't experienced it, maybe more than it was. I remember how excited I was for the prequel trilogy, and then how that turned around with how over time I began to realize how let down I had been. But the new trilogy certainly does have certain aspects that may privilege it as a more exciting moment, not the least of which is J.J. Abrams. You know, 20 years ago, to have a Star Trek director do a Star Wars movie might have been considered blasphemy by these otherwise opposed fan bases. But the work Abrams has done, you know, I like all of his work. I think that, you know, what he did with Star Trek was interesting. It made it fun again. It made it new again. And I think that his other work, you know, I love Cloverfield and Super 8. I think he's a great choice. I think he's an intelligent director who could take this in a really exciting new direction. He said in an interview with Paris Match that he's trying to sort of recapture some of the mythological aesthetic of the first trilogy and avoid some of the pitfalls of the prequel trilogy. But I think the big thing is that we have characters from the original trilogy available to us again. You know, other than a childish Anakin and a questionably congruent Obi-Wan Kenobi, we have Luke and Leia and Han coming back and Chewie. And of course, I think that the fans of the original trilogy, that alone is certainly going to heighten the excitement. Certainly I'm feeling that. You know, I'm wondering where Luke is in these trailers that I've seen, and I'm excited. I get all emotional when I hear Han Solo say, "Chewie, we're home," and telling these young cast members now that it's true, it's all true. The exact opposite language on the Millennium Falcon in the original trilogy when he says, "I don't believe," and now, you know, it's true, all of it. It's pretty exciting stuff with the original cast coming back, even if they're only in peripheral roles. So I think that yeah, that might be heightening the excitement for the fan base, most certainly.
You mentioned, of course, J.J. Abrams and Star Trek, and one of the criticisms that he got for that was his overuse of lens flares, and people are concerned that could ruin the Force Awakens. Your thoughts on that?
You know, I haven't invested a lot of energy thinking about that. I became aware of the overuse of lens flares after the fact when I read, you know, he's been accused of overuse of lens flares, and then you go back through the movies and you see, oh yeah, he did. And yeah, you know, in terms of what's called cinematic suture, how invested you become in the realism, how much you're involved in the melodrama on screen, and how much you're taken out of that melodrama by certain formal things like lens flares, which are meta-cinematic. They point out that what you're seeing is through a camera, even if it's artificially constructed. So, you know, yeah, maybe. I don't know that that is the... I think if you're focused on that as the greatest weakness of the Star Trek trilogy, what that indicates is that you're really reaching for weaknesses, which suggests that they're pretty strong overall. You know, otherwise they're pretty strong. I hope he doesn't beat the heck out of lens flares. If I could, you know, bring the question to a head with that, yeah, I hope he doesn't overdo it, but I don't care.
We were talking earlier about controversy, and there was another one when Carrie Fisher came out and said that Disney had asked her to lose weight to reprise the role of Leia. And I think, I mean, obviously we've come a long way, but I still think that Hollywood is sexist in a lot of ways. There was a thing earlier about Maggie Gyllenhaal, who's 37, was too old to play the love interest of, like Bruce Willis or something like that. What do you make of that and sort of how Hollywood is treating its female actors?
Well, yeah, I mean, Hollywood has historically been painfully misogynist. I mean, that goes without saying. The female spectacle, you know, you've got Judith Butler, Carol Clover, a whole range of feminist theorists making quite clear how women have been positioned as spectacle while men have been positioned as sort of the narrative motivators, typically. You know, not in every case. I'm not suggesting there's no progressive films. But, yeah, you know, so Leia is coming back and she's being asked to lose weight. But I don't know that is the strongest indicator of the misogyny. I mean, Mark Hamill was, I don't mean to suggest there's not. I think that yes, you're correct, that it's, Hollywood is deeply misogynist, and there's a double standard. And in fact, in that Maggie Gyllenhaal thing you mentioned, I recently saw, I think it was on Facebook, a little video meme that is circulating of a number of young, beautiful female actors who are now in their mid-30s, who are undergoing, it's a satirical video, undergoing academic retraining for their new roles in Hollywood now that they're too old to be love interests for 60-year-old men. But I think Mark Hamill was also asked to lose weight. And while I do think Carrie Fisher, I have to see the movies. We'll have to see what type of a role she has. Certainly in the first movie, she was reduced. She came out strong as a leader of a rebellion and was then reduced to a damsel in distress almost immediately. And of course, she was pretty much the only female next to Mon Mothma that was in the original trilogy. So certainly they were not the narrative motivators, if they were the nexus of energy. Let's save Leia. That's obviously, there's a lot of feminist critique available to that. You know, anyone listening should consider reading Laura Mulvey, although there's been criticisms of her work. It really is a seminal work in understanding how women have been visually located and men have been narratively located. But I think that outside of the feminist aspects of it, these are people being cast as action heroes. And Mark Hamill needed to lose weight. If you're an action hero, you need to lose weight. I'm 5'6". And I'm never going to be a fireman or policeman just because I'm short. And at some point, action heroes have to sort of fit the role. But yeah, I think that's one example of many we might point to in which Carrie Fisher is facing the misogyny of Hollywood. Although her interview was hilarious. Did you hear it?
The Good Morning America one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was brilliant. I loved it because she was so unfiltered. I think that's what people enjoyed.
Yeah, I think so too. She quite dominated. I think Carrie Fisher demonstrated her strength of character as what might misogynistically now be called a Hollywood matriarch. I loved it. I thought she was great.
Finally, you brought up Mark Hamill, and there are so many theories about Luke and why he's not in the trailer. One I read suggests that Luke is really Kylo Ren because there's the hand holding the Darth Vader mask, and has Luke gone to the dark side because he kind of looks like the shadowy Obi-Wan character. I heard an interview with Harrison Ford said he's the reason why he's not in the trailer is because the surprise around Luke is so good. Do you have any theories as to why Luke wasn't in the trailer or wasn't on the poster at all?
I do, but these are only theories. You know, J.J. Abrams and the marketing team have been very careful to give us just enough not information, right? So that nothing can be known for certain. But first of all, he was in the trailer. He was in the second trailer, at least as a voice, maybe disembodied, but that's clearly Luke's voice. And there was a little bit of an addition at the end of that iconic speech, which is from a Jedi when he sort of enigmatically informs Leia that Vader is their father and she is his sister. It's the Force is strong in my family. My father has it, I have it, and my sister has it. And then he adds an element in the new trailer, in the second of the trailers, in which he says, "You have that power too." And it seems that the visual, how the visuals align, I think that character with the hood on and the mechanical hand reaching up to touch R2 in a sort of romantic way, that seems like a moment of familiarity. I think that is Luke. And yeah, he's a shadowy character, but I hesitate. You know, Kylo Ren, we know the actor, and it's been made clear that he takes the mask off in a couple of places. So I don't think that theory holds water unless we've been intentionally led down the garden path. I think Luke may be a sort of Yoda-type character who has gone into some sort of hermitage, suffering from the effects of force power, and will come back. You know, Yoda was only introduced in the second of the original trilogy, and maybe Luke will be this type of shadowy, powerful background force mentor that must be sought out by the young characters. I would hesitate. You know, I think J.J. Abrams would be taking a big risk by locating Luke on the dark side of the Force in terms of trying to intentionally avoid alienating a fan base. But nothing is known for sure, but I don't think so. I don't think so, but I'm just guessing.
Well, the Force Awakens opens next Friday. I know I will be there. I'm sure you will be too. We look forward to whatever is in store. Everyone's going a little bit nuts. David Christopher, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thanks, Dan. Any opportunity to talk about Star Wars?
Yes, for sure. I love talking with fellow fans and fellow from a sort of academic perspective too. Alrighty, have a good day.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
That was David Christopher, PhD student at the University of Victoria in Cinema Studies, and who has been long trying to get a class on Star Wars on the curriculum. Okay. Well, a couple of days ago, I had the privilege and honor of speaking with evolutionary biologist, public intellectual, and author Richard Dawkins about his part two of his memoir, Brief Candle in the Dark. It was a very fascinating conversation, so let's get right to it. This is my conversation with Richard Dawkins. Evolutionary biologist and author Richard Dawkins. Richard, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
So your new memoir is Brief Candle in the Dark. It's part two of your memoirs. What motivated you to write your memoirs in the first place?
Well, I was getting on a bit. I reached my 70s, and my mother was going strong, and I thought it would be good to consult her. She has a very good memory. And I used her diaries of my early childhood. That was in volume one, actually, An Appetite for Wonder. And it was originally supposed to be just one volume, but when I got halfway through, I decided I needed a bit of a break. And I wanted part two of my life to be really done a bit differently, not done chronologically, but done thematically. And so I asked the publishers if they'd mind splitting it in two, and they didn't. All except the German ones who wanted it to stay in one. And Brief Candle in the Dark is volume two, volume one having been published in 2013.
And in Brief Candle, it's definitely, I guess, less structured and more science-based, I would say, in terms of what you're talking about. Why did you decide to jump around back and forth like that a little bit?
In volume one, it was clearly a good idea to do it chronologically. Childhood works like that. You're getting older all the time, you're changing all the time. Chronology makes sense. In volume two, I didn't think chronology made sense, really, because what happened next is not necessarily very interesting. Sometimes it's too interesting. And I thought it better to divide it thematically so that there is some science in it, but there is in volume one as well. There's a chapter on television, there's a chapter on debates, there's a chapter on travel. Chapter on various other things. It's thematic rather than chronological.
What I found interesting is that in sort of contrast to the your perceived public persona, you come across as quite maybe timid, so to speak, both how you talk and just your work. Given that aspect of your personality, did that make it harder for you to look back at your life and write about it with such force?
Well, maybe the public persona that you speak of is simply wrong. Maybe the persona in the autobiography is the correct one.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough. So on that note, how did you adjust initially to becoming a quote-unquote celebrity, first after The Selfish Gene and then a different kind of celebrity after The God Delusion was published?
Yes, I don't think of myself as that much of a celebrity. I mean, I don't get sort of stopped in the street all the time or anything like that. So there's not that much of a difference, and such as it was, it came on gradually. So, it didn't require a great deal of adjustment.
One of the passages I really enjoyed in Brief Candle was when you're talking about the supernatural and skepticism. How would you describe supernatural belief? Is it simply anything that can't be explained by science?
Yes, it's an interesting question, because I'm actually not clear that supernatural means anything at all, except, as you say, that which can't be explained by science yet. If you think back to the Middle Ages, almost everything that is familiar to us today, computers, cars, planes, telephones, would have seemed supernatural to them. And I dare say that the developments, technological developments of the future would seem supernatural to us. So I think that to invoke the supernatural to explain anything is a kind of cowardice, a kind of cop-out. What we should be saying is, here's something we don't yet understand, but we're working on it.
Is it sort of the same as saying, is describing something or someone as alien because we don't know what it is?
Yes, I suppose it is. I mean, if you use the word alien to mean hypothetical visitors from outer space, that's an interesting question, and presumably they would seem very alien to us. But yes, I think you're probably right.
So on that note, though, do you think there are certain ideas or certain theories that maybe will never be or can never be explained by science or reason?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There could be. It could be that there are really deep problems which are not beyond science itself, but beyond the human brain to encompass. And I don't know what I think about that. I mean, there are some physicists who think that potentially they can explain everything. On the other hand, it's pretty remarkable how much we already can understand, given that our brains were shaped to survive on the African savannah, hunting and gathering. The fact that those very same brains, without any change at all genetically, can understand quantum theory and relativity and evolution is pretty much of a tribute to our species. And so it seems to me an open-ended question how much more we might be able to understand, and whether there are some problems so deep that we can never understand them.
One of the other passages I really enjoyed was when you talked about going to Galapagos for the first time, which is, of course, where Darwin studied his finches. What was that experience like for you, visiting that haven on Earth for the first time?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, actually, the impact it had on Darwin is a bit exaggerated. Darwin was a great naturalist, but he didn't really put it together until he got back to England afterwards. He did sort of notice that something about the Galapagos fauna looked as though a species from the mainland had been taken. He said it's almost as though a species from the mainland had been taken and modified. So there was a sort of inkling there. But I was immensely struck by Galapagos. The enormous number of animals, the tameness of them, the fact that you can get close to them, you can touch them. You're not allowed to touch them, but you could if you wanted to. You have to step over the iguanas. They don't get out of your way. The same goes for the boobies. It is an astonishing experience.
And so in the last 30 years or so, you've started to dabble in
That's not my phone, is it?
No, let me just... Sorry, okay. It's my studio phone.
Okay.
Sorry about that. In the last 30 years or so, you've dabbled in television documentaries.
Yes.
And what are your thoughts now on how science is being portrayed in pop culture and the media, both in a documentary sense and in more of a fiction sci-fi sense?
I think there are some very good science documentaries. I think David Attenborough is peerless and wonderful. I'm not so enamored of some of the others. Sci-fi, I don't watch very many science fiction films. I've read a certain number of science fiction novels. I do value science fiction. I think that science fiction can open the mind, can get you to think scientifically. I think that I've actually had my scientific mind opened by science fiction, more by books than by films. I would like to see television treating science more sympathetically. I'd like to see scientists portrayed on television, perhaps in soap operas and dramas, as sympathetic characters, as characters who are human but have something really interesting to say and do. And I've been to a certain extent involved in trying to persuade Hollywood to take science more seriously and give it more humanity.
But on that note, I mean, do you feel that, I don't know, within the last 10, 15 years, essentially since the Bush era, that science has become more of a political hot-button issue than maybe it should be?
I'm not sure about that. I think there's a certain amount of hostility to science, which is unfortunate. That may be just a part of hostility towards intellectualism generally, but I'm not much of a voyeur of the social scene, actually. I'm not very good at that kind of thing.
Now, you write that around the time your book The God Delusion came out, the term New Atheist was coined, and you sort of became willingly or unwillingly a part of that group with Harris and Hitch and Dennett. Do you embrace that label, or sort of embrace being thrust into that group at all?
I don't mind it. I don't think there's anything very new about it. I mean, there's nothing much that Bertrand Russell didn't say. I suppose we did have a certain impact. The four of us wrote books at around the same time, and it did seem to hit a nerve. The book sold very well. The God Delusion has now sold 3 million copies. And so, to some extent, the phrase new can be justified.
But on that note, it seems like after that book came out, you sort of became more of a figure, an anti-religious secular figure, than you did for your work on science. How did that feel to you?
Well, I suppose the God Delusion did initiate that, and I've always been non-religious, and you can tell that from really all of my books. But the God Delusion was a bit of a departure for me, I suppose, and I followed that up by journalism and broadcast and that kind of thing, television too.
When you first got into television, you sort of described yourself as, you know, reluctant and timid. How did you make that transition? Was it seamless for you?
Yeah, I described that in Brief Candle in the Dark. I mean, I was first approached to do a television documentary after The Selfish Gene came out, and they wanted to do a program on The Selfish Gene, and I was too timid to do that. So John Maynard Smith did it instead, and he did it very well. And then 10 years later, I did a couple of BBC Horizon programs. I'd become less timid by then. And then more recently, I've done a number for Channel 4, which I quite enjoyed doing them. I quite enjoyed having done them. I quite enjoy the end of the day's work. I find it a bit of a strain, actually, during the day's work.
And, you know, you're sort of, in many ways, rightly or wrongly, or willingly or unwillingly, featured on TV as a public intellectual. Do you like that term?
I'm a bit bewildered by it, in a way, bemused by it. I don't think of myself as a public intellectual. I'm not ready to hold forth on any topic that anybody asks me about. I always refuse to go on sort of political talk shows where the panel gets asked topical questions of the day arising out of the day's news. I don't feel that I'm a pundit who's qualified to speak on such things. I'd much rather say, I'm sorry, I just don't know about that. I'm not educated in that. I haven't done the research, which you can't do if you're a public intellectual.
You mentioned a moment ago John Maynard Smith, and you talk a lot about in this book about your heroes, you know, someone like him or Stephen Jay Gould. Why was it important for you to talk about those figures in your life?
When you write an autobiography, you are expected, I think, reasonably so, to talk about people you've known. I talk about people that I've known who are famous and people who are not famous. And I don't hold off talking about people who are famous, but people who have been influential to me, like John Maynard Smith. I would not include Stephen Jay Gould in that, by the way. But people like John Maynard Smith or W.D. Hamilton, who have been influential, P.B. Medawar. I think it's perfectly right to talk about people who've influenced me, whether they're famous or not.
One aspect that you talk about and that you become known for is your ties, which are of course hand painted by your wife. When was the first time that started for you? Do you remember?
Oh goodness, I'm trying to remember that. I think she started painting silk scarves for women, great big you know silk scarves, and then she switched to ties. I forget what the first one was. They're always animals. She always starts with white silk and paints animals on them. One that I talk about in Brief Candle in the Dark is the warthog tie, which I wore to Buckingham Palace on the one occasion when I was invited to lunch by the Queen. And the Queen didn't like it because she, she said the animals were ugly. And I rather liked that. I thought it was rather admirable that the Queen doesn't just talk in cliches but actually says what she thinks, and so I was rather pleased at that. And I said, when she said, why do you wear such ugly animals on your tie, I said, ma'am, if they are ugly, how much greater is the artistry to make it into such a beautiful tie?
What was that like for you? Here you are, an Oxford scientist, and you get to go to meet the Queen of your country.
Well, I was quite amused by it, and it's a thing she did every week, and she invited an eclectic mixture of guests. I mean, I had a prima ballerina, I had the captain of the Australian rugby team, I had a leading Muslim, Britain's leading Muslim, I had the director of the Royal Academy, and various other people, six corgis under the table. It was a fun lunch. I enjoyed it.
So given now that you've written your memoirs, what do you want your legacy to be, or how do you want people to remember you?
I should like to be remembered as a scientist who was passionately keen on communicating science to as many people as possible, because it is so wonderful.
Well, I would definitely agree with that. You got me interested in science all over again when I read your books, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading both Appetite for Wonder and Brief Candle in the Dark. Richard Dawkins, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Alrighty, have a good one. That was Richard Dawkins, and his book is Brief Candle in the Dark. Excuse me. This has been Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're going to take you out with the Kyla Koopman Band and Celtic Grass. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye. I am joined now by